Hello and welcome to this talk, Seth Explained with Raspberry Pis. My name is Sven Seeberg. I am working for SUSE in the documentation team. And today, I want to use Raspberry Pis to explain Seth at least a little. The problem initially, I thought, Raspberry Pis could be used. They do not fit the system requirements, but they do not miss that far, but okay, I thought I could use them. And then I started building the slides and I wanted to put a recommendation there that they should not be used for production purposes. And now my conclusion after running the first test is you shouldn't use them for any purposes except running LEDs on them. Okay, and I want to emphasize that I'm not a Ceph expert or anything like that. I'm just having fun with Raspberry Pis and deploying a Ceph cluster. But I will try to explain the core concepts of Ceph with the help of the LEDs attached to the Raspberry Pis. Okay, and as this is a live demo, here's the warning. It is a live demo. Don't expect it to work, at least all the time. And I know that some of the things I did here with LEDs could also be done with several monitoring tools, for example, OpenATIC, but for the heck of it, I used LEDs. Okay. If there are questions during the talk, please feel free to ask anytime and remind me to repeat it for the microphone. I do not want to talk about how you set up your Ceph cluster at home. I don't want to explain how to administrate it. And I'm not going into detailed information about the features. I'm just going to explain the general ideas behind Ceph. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. There are some other talks on Sunday. For example, Joshua has a talk at 11 a.m. About how to deploy a Ceph cluster with Salt. I recommend going there if you want to set up your own Ceph cluster at home. And Abby and Dennis are talking about how to monitor your Ceph cluster with Elasticsearch. Okay, now what is Ceph? These bullet points are basically on every slide that is introducing Ceph. It's software defined storage, it's open source, highly scalable. The developers claim it's scaling into the petabytes, and it actually does. You can run hundreds of terabytes or even hundreds of petabytes of storage with Ceph. The interesting part is that you can use, let's say, commodity hardware, but not as commodity as Raspberry Pis. And the whole thing is self-healing managing. What that means, I will explain later. And the other interesting part, and that already saved my ass a few times, it doesn't have a single point of failure. So some of the Pis already crashed, and I could manage to it continued to run. Okay, and Ceph is finally something that barely runs on Raspberry Pis. Another word about Ceph in general, it does not magically solve all storage problems. You really need to know what your requirements are, and you need to define your cluster requirements accordingly. Now, before I start talking about the concepts and demonstrating a few things, I want to... is the microphone volume okay? Yeah, okay. I first want to give a short introduction into the different nodes that are used in a Ceph cluster, especially the two I'm using right now that are the OSD and monitor nodes. The other ones that are usually associated with Ceph clusters are in theory available in here, but I did not have the time to set them up, so we are going not to use them. First of all, there are the OSDs, the object storage devices. The Ceph OSD is short for object storage device, and the OSD daemon is the daemon that is handling the raw disk, so to speak. They actually store the data in the cluster. They always communicate with each other, and they take care that data is replicated within the cluster. So I can say I want 3 replications of each object in the cluster, and they will automatically do that. And if one node fails, they will take another node and duplicate the data there. So I always have the 3 replications available. And they also, yeah, I already mentioned that basically. They see failures of other OSDs and begin replicating data again. The OSD is the daemon that is managing the data on a disk, or it could potentially be 2 disks. One is used for the data, the other one is used for the journal of the data, for the object stored on a data disk. You can have both partitions on one hard drive. It is usually recommended to put the journal on an SSD and the data on a magnetic drive that is much slower. In this case, I'm using very slow USB drives, and the performance is accordingly. Okay. The monitor nodes are used to track the status of the cluster. So they always know which nodes are available in the cluster and exchange this map called crush map, but I will talk about this later, between each other. So they always communicate with each other about the current status of the cluster. And they usually decide, or not usually, they decide by majority which map or which version of the map is the current map and the right version. And that's why I have 3 large racks, I call them racks, of Raspberry Pis in here. Yeah, about that in a few minutes. Okay. And then the other ones, for example, the metadata server is used for, if you want to export a file system that is POSIX compatible, you could use the metadata server, or Redis Gateway basically provides a REST API to the object stored in the cluster. And now to give you an insight into the setup of the nodes here, I had to swear a lot during the last days setting this whole thing up. And yeah, my colleagues began changing cluster to cluster fake. And yeah, that's how I'm calling it right now, because it's not really a Ceph cluster. Okay, at the top of each rack, there's a monitor node. There are 3 monitor nodes, because they always need a majority to decide. And if you have, for example, 4 nodes and one node fails, then 3 nodes can still decide about a new version of the map. But if the second one fails, then there's no majority, and therefore there's no real advantage over having just 3 nodes. So you can always have just 1 failure in any case. So therefore, I'm using 3 monitor nodes. And in my theoretical setup, I wanted to put them each in one rack and maybe distribute the racks in different rooms in my data center, and therefore have a pretty good availability in case of power failures in one room, for example. Okay, and then on the lower left, the 2 nodes are currently unused. The upper left node is used as an administrator node, and you're going to see what is going on later on there. And then there are some nice LEDs I wanted to show on the webcam. I'm hoping that is working later on, and you can see the LEDs. There are currently 3 different traffic lights, basically. And you see there are always 3 LEDs on the top nodes, and they, like any traffic light, red is not good, yellow is okayish, and green is good. And for the admin node, that means the whole cluster is fine. And for the other 3, that means yellow, they agreed on a new map. And when one is red, that basically means that something is wrong, and green, everything is fine. And they will show a heartbeat all the time. And then there are other LEDs on each storage node. Red currently means, correct. Red means write, and green LED means currently the device is reading. And yeah, I'm hoping you can see the colors later on. Before I am going into the details about how Ceph is handling all the data and going to demonstrate that, a few other things about how you can access the data and how Ceph is basically handling all that. All data in Ceph is basically stored in objects. Objects reside somewhere called pools, and you can access the objects in the pools via REST, for example, the Redis gateway I earlier mentioned. You can also use the Ceph file system, and you can also export actual block devices, and there are other tools that allow exporting iSCSI and so on. I'm going to use for this demonstration a command line tool called Rados that is directly interacting with the cluster. And there are also libraries available in many programming languages that allow you to write programs that directly interact with the cluster. Okay, how does Ceph manage all the things, scaling into petabytes and not have any single point of failure? And I think there are many talks about this, and I'm having another run at it. And yeah, the thing responsible for this is called CRUSH, Controlled Scalable Decentralized Placement of Replicated Data. And CRUSH is an algorithm-based approach to storing data. And it does not require a lot of information to calculate where the data should be stored. It just needs the name of the object to be stored. It needs to know the pool, the logical partition, where to store the data. And it requires a current status of the cluster, which nodes are available and if they're online or offline. And then you can also place some constraints on the cluster. For example, in the setup, I would like to have one replication of each object on each rack. So if one room goes offline or one rack goes offline, for example, when I plug off power supply, then one rack goes offline. And I'm going to let it run for a couple of minutes because Raspberry Pis are slow and they will take some time to realize that some nodes are gone. Okay, you already see the... Oh, no, you can't see it. Sorry. No, you can't see it still. Still can't see it. You see that the yellow LED is running right now, that blinking. That means that they realize something is wrong, but it will still take some time. Okay, let's continue. Then there are the user-defined constraints on the placement, as mentioned, and they are written in something called the CRUSH map. And yeah, so I already started with the first demonstration. I unplugged one of the racks, and what you probably can see, no, you can't because, okay, so now you can see that the Raspberries here in those racks are not doing a lot. That's because, now they're, can you see it that they are blinking here? Yeah, sort of. Okay, now they start blinking. Yeah, that's what should happen. Now they realize that all the nodes here are gone and the replications are not, there are not three replications available anymore. So they start copying the still existing replications of data to other nodes so that I regain my three total replications I wanted to have in the cluster. The cluster status during that time is not very healthy. And that is signaled by the currently red LED. So there are two different statuses of the Ceph cluster. One is error, one is warn, that are not good. But error does not mean that it's not, that it's crashing. Error can also mean it just takes some time to recover. So red does not mean that it's totally failing. Okay. Now, you want to store the data in something like partitions. Having all data objects in one partition is not very useful. For example, you want to grant user rights to different parts of the cluster, and that is achieved by the things called pools, as mentioned previously. Now you may think, wow, I know partitions, easy stuff. And yeah, basically it is. The pools are, from the outside, acting like yeah, very similar to partitions. You can, for example, create snapshots, and yeah, you can define rules for each pool. For example, the replication level, you can say this pool should have 3 replication, the other one only 2. And then there are different modes for replications. I will talk about this later. Now, that's not all. Inside, there's something called placement groups. And the placement groups are basically helping Ceph to organize the data within the cluster. If you have thousands or millions of objects in one pool, each node has to know, or should, in theory, be able to calculate where each object is currently stored. And this is very expensive in CPU time. Therefore, the complexity is reduced with the placement groups. And the placement groups are just groups of objects packed together, and they are put together based on their names. So there's something like a hash function that is deciding which placement group an object resides in. And each placement group then uses a defined set of OSDs to store the data. Yeah, and the placement groups are one of the most important, maybe the most important performance factor. Okay, so when I want to store an object in the cluster, I decide I want to put it in pool A or pool B. The pools then are divided into a number of placement groups. There are some, yeah, you have to calculate it depending on the number of nodes you're having in your cluster, but I'm not going into this right now, or not in this talk. And then the Ceph is creating the hash of the file name, deciding, well, this file goes into placement group 1 of the pool, or placement group 2 of the pool, or maybe another placement group when I'm putting it in another pool. The OSDs can be used by several placement groups at the same time, so there's no need that just one placement group is using one node, OSD, and it, for performance reasons, it's even better to have multiple placement groups on one node. The average should be around 150. Okay, and then there are some neat things going on. When I begin writing an object into one placement group, or to specifically one OSD, the client knows which OSD it needs to contact and store the object on. And then the OSD knows that it has to create 2 other replications of the object and begins writing those replications to other nodes. And as soon as the replications are finished and the writing on of all 3 objects or replications is finished, then the primary OSD, that's the one that was contacted at the beginning, sends a signal back to the client that the object has been successfully stored. And so this is not that fast, because I first need to contact one OSD, this one needs to contact 2 other, or maybe more or less, depends on your configuration, and needs to write all the stuff, and then afterwards it can send the finished signal. On the other hand, reading is much better, because when your client does not only know the primary node it can contact, but also knows all the other nodes that store the replications of the object. So they can, by themselves, just choose any other node contacted and read the object from there. So that makes parallel reading very efficient. Yeah, so about the placement groups, as I mentioned before, they just reduce the complexity of tracking each object and reduce calculating the time where the object resides. And they are impacting the performance, because as soon as one node fails, the data has to be duplicated again or replicated somewhere else. When the other nodes realize that one node is gone, then they begin checking, well, I'm also having replications of this specific placement group, and then they are contacting other nodes and putting all the stuff they have stored in the placement groups that are now do not have enough replications. They will begin storing this data, these placement groups, on other nodes as well. And depending on your cluster size, well, if you have a few placement groups per node, then you can this node can only contact 5, 6, 7 other OSDs, for example. If you have only 7 placement groups on one node, it can just contact 7 other, at most 7 other OSDs, and begin writing this data to 7 other nodes, for example. If you have much more placement groups, on the other hand, then at some point it's not improving the performance anymore. You know, okay, I have to mention that writing usually takes longer than reading. So while one node is pushing all the data, the other ones have to write, and yeah, so the bottleneck is usually the writing, and the more the more other nodes the remaining OSD can write, the faster the process is. At some point, of course, the network is the bottleneck, therefore having more placement groups does not improve performance. But then you begin having other problems. Having too many placement groups is also, again, very expensive on the computing side. Okay, now I'm hoping no. Okay, so that's the thing with live demos is beginning to start. And usually it should not take that long to... Okay, I have to plug it in again. Okay, let's see what's going to happen. Now, as soon as the Raspberries come online again, then... Okay, maybe I can just explain currently what's going on. I need to put aside the chameleon, and I need to change the view, and I maybe can put it in full screen. Okay, so currently there are two OSDs remaining, the ones over here, and you see that the two green LEDs are blinking. That means there are still more than 50% of the monitors are available, and they can still decide what is going about what is going on in the cluster. And yeah, so as soon as now the new nodes are coming online, and you see they will soon contact the remaining nodes, and then the thing that one of the selling points of Ceph come in, and now the cluster is beginning to redistribute the data. So you can see that the nodes in here are beginning to read and write, and those nodes over here will receive all the data that has been changed or moved during the time they were offline. So now the data is rebalanced over all nodes, and after a few minutes the cluster should be back to its original state, because I did not change that, not the original state, but the data basically should be back where it was before I took the one rack offline. Okay. And yeah, while this is going on, I can continue. So there are two different modes of how Ceph handles the replications. One mode is called replicate. Yeah, is used in replicated pools. That's basically what I was talking about the whole time. And then there's another thing, because replications are expensive on the storage side. You need, if you have three replications, you need 3 times the storage you need for just storing the file once or object once. And yeah, that just costs a lot of money if you have a lot of data. And then you can also do something that is similar to RAID, RAID 5 or 6. You split your data object into chunks and you create parity chunks for the data. So you can, for example, split your object in 2 chunks and create 1 parity chunk, then you can have one failure. You can maintain the cluster with 1 failure, so the data is still available when one rack fails or one node fails. But if another node fails, then the data is not available anymore. In contrast to the replicated pool, where one surviving copy is enough to have the data still available. That means in this case, if I want to store the data in replicated pools, I will have to use 3 times the storage the file usually uses. And if I use an erasure coded pool, it just uses, when I use this configuration that I want to split the file into two parts, have one parity chunk, then I will use only 50% overhead of my disks for storing the data. But that comes at a cost. If I want to read now this data from the OSDs, I need to contact at least two OSDs, fetch the data from both, and then calculate or put my file back together with CPU. So it costs CPU time. Reading data from much more CPU time reading data from erasure coded pools than from replicated pools. When writing data to replicated pools, it also takes a lot of bandwidth in the back end. So the file is written to one OSD, this has to contact two others or four others or maybe just one other OSD. So it produces a large load on the backend network. I lost myself. To erasure codes. Yeah, and on the other hand, you can have more efficient data storage usage and trade this off against CPU time. Okay, now it's not working for some reason. I'm not sure why. Let's have a look. And this is one of the reasons why you shouldn't do live. Okay. And all my tests, well, it looks, no, it doesn't look fine. Some pools are broken. I will just delete them for the sake of the demonstration. And I need to put away the microphone for a second. Okay, now the pools should be removed and it should take another couple of minutes. Now the cluster screen again. So it's restored. I can now create new pools. Failure handling. In order to do all the things Ceph promises it can do, you need some user interaction. You need to, when you just install Ceph, it treats every node similar to each any other node. It just puts the data on any node that is available. If you want, for example, to have data distributed over different racks, you have to manually tell the cluster, well, these nodes reside in one rack, the other nodes in another rack, and maybe you have a third rack, and those racks can be in rows of racks, and the rows can again be in rooms or data centers. So you can basically define the full structure you have in your data center, and therefore distribute or the data everywhere in your different rooms and guarantee a high availability. And this is done with the crash map. And the crash map, that's when you decompile it, it's just a text file where you can say, well, these OSDs belong to one thing called bucket, and these buckets are in a hierarchy, so one can reside in another bucket, and these are basically the things that are the racks, the nodes, and upper level are data center rooms, and so on. Okay, now what's going on when, no, sorry, not what's going on, I already mentioned. Now when devices fail in, I already mentioned that. I can jump over that slide. Now, I can put data on different pools, and I can define for each pool, well, And for the state and this pool is not that important. I just want two replications because I don't want to waste my storage for them. And I can decide, well, other objects are much more important. Maybe I want to have four replications. And then on the other hand, I can also use the erasure coded pools to do this whole thing more storage efficient. Now, if I use, don't define any structure for the cluster, the advantage is that every other node can be used for replication. So if one node fails, any other node can jump in and can be used for replacing the failed node. If I, on the other hand, begin defining another structure, maybe Rex in this case, and I'm telling the cluster, well, put one object in the first rack, one replication in the second rack, and the third replication in the third rack, and one rack fails, then basically not all nodes are available for replication. Or if maybe just one node fails in the third rack, only the two remaining nodes in the third rack are available for a replication. Therefore, there are some disadvantages for using this, but disadvantages maybe going a little too far. You have to provision your cluster and taking this into account. So you need enough remaining nodes available. More important are the monitor nodes. You usually do not have that many monitor nodes in your cluster. And one scenario might be that you have two server rooms in your building, and you have maybe two monitors in one room and three monitors in the other room. Now, if the room with the three monitors goes offline, then basically your cluster is stuck. It cannot operate anymore. And so you usually should have a third site where, well, some monitors reside, and you have two and two in each server room, and maybe a fifth monitor in another location that is available or connected to both other locations. So it's acting as a tiebreaker in case of one room fails. Okay, so if I'm using, if I'm distributing my objects over different racks, I am also having the advantage that, for example, if the infrastructure fails, the switch that is connecting the whole rack or the power supply unit that is supplying the whole rack is going offline, then the cluster is still able to operate normally. Of course, it takes some time to redistribute the data. You already saw that when I plugged off the power supply for the third rack. It takes, yeah, well, in this case, it took much more because the cluster failed totally. And I can try again. Maybe it's going to work this time. But no, I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to take away one. Yeah, not that hard to it right now. Okay, so I just took one node offline, and what should happen is I took the upper node here in the third rack offline, and at some point the other nodes again should realize that this node is gone, and you will see that the red and green LEDs start. No, this is not the thing that now it's going to start. Now you see that they begin blinking a lot, and they begin redistributing the data that was stored on the first node on the cluster, third rack, and yeah, storing it on the remaining nodes. And of course, they have to read it from the nodes in the other racks. It's fine. Okay. And then there's one thing that is important when using those different pools, erasure-coded and replicated pools. If you're using a replicated pool, it does not matter which node replaces the node that is gone. If the first node fails, that is the primary node that is contacted in case someone wants to write an object to the pool, then you want, if this first node goes offline, you want another node that already has all copies to immediately jump in. So what you're doing is you're queuing all the OSDs that are used for the placement group, and as soon as one OSD fails, like in here, they are all jumping in one place ahead in the queue. And then the next OSD is used to replicate the data there. And this is especially important if the first node fails and then the second node is immediately there and can continue operating the cluster, or the pool, sorry. And more specific, the placement group. This is done on the placement group level. On the other hand, if you're using an erasure-coded pool, the position of the OSDs in the is important. That means if the object is split into different into chunks, then the first part is stored in the first OSD, the second part in the second OSD, and so on. And now, if one node fails, they should not change the position, because then all the chunks have to be moved to the new nodes in the placement group. And therefore, what you would like to do is you just replace the failed node with any other node that is somewhere in the cluster, and you begin replicating the data on this new node. So you do not want to change the order of the remaining nodes, because that would mean additional time moving data within the placement group or placement groups. Okay. I think I'm already pretty much, yeah, okay. I will just plug that in right again. And sorry, the demonstration part came a little short because it took too much time to recover from the first failure. And yeah, so just to give you some insight what the Raspberries are capable of, I ran some performance tests, and you can write around 1.6 megabytes per second into the cluster. I did not do any read tests because I did not have time. It's nice for displaying on the LEDs what is happening, but performance-wise, it's really bad. So you do not want to use it even at home for playing around. And yeah. What you can also do with the different sorts of pools, you can do something that is called cache tiering. You can use an EC pool in the background and put a replicated pool in front of it, and all objects that are written to this cache tiered pool first will be put into the replicated pool, and they reside there for some period of time, and then at some point they will be written to the cold storage to the EC erasure coded pool. So when you want to access this object and it's already in the replicated pool that is residing above the erasure coded pool, then you can access this file again with several clients from several OSDs at the same time. And only if you're not using this object anymore, it's flushed from the replicated pool and moved to the, it's always moved to the EC erasure coded pool, but then as soon as it's not that important anymore and you need it again, then you have to retrieve it from the erasure coded pool. So that's basically a compromise between both worlds. You get some improvements in performance, at least sometimes. Depends heavily on what you actually want to do with that. And you also get some efficiency out of the erasure-coded pool storage mechanism. Okay. I'm going to jump over that, and I'm going to stop here because I wanted to leave 20 minutes for questions and answers. And if there are no questions and answers, I could try again to do some demonstrations. But first, I want to take questions if there are any. Yeah, there's one. Yes, microphone.
When you offline the third rack.
The what?
Well, it's probably not. When you offline the third rack and you put it online again, it yes. started writing data, but it already had it. And the OSDs should have known they have it.
I do not exactly know how that is handled in detail, but usually you have to assume that during the time it was offline, at least some of the data changed. So it at least needs to compare what happened, and probably it's doing that, but I'm not sure about, I don't know. Basically, I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe someone else in the room does. There are some people involved that could know it, but yeah, I do not. Other questions?
You mentioned that you could describe a hierarchical structure like the room and the rack and the nodes. So if I have two rooms, look, maybe I understood it wrong, but like, would that also mean like the replication in that rooms, like, would they cross-replicate, or if like one
yes.
room fails?
So if I need to manually define that. So I have nodes in one room, nodes in the other room, and by itself, Ceph will treat each node equally.
Yeah.
So it could by accident, all replications could land in one room. But if I tell Ceph, well, these nodes are in one room and these nodes are in the other room, and I tell it I want one at least one replication in each room, then it will do that.
Okay,
so, but I have manually
I have to tell it
manually
cool.
to do so. Okay. Any other questions? No. Okay. I will maybe go back a few slides and then try to, if you're interested, yeah. To do the where did I lose the okay. I think what I want to do first is again create I'm not sure whether there is still an existing pool in the cluster. I first need to check that. Yeah, so I deleted all the pools. So all the demonstration I did after deleting the pools was basically bogus. So I first need to create another pool, and I will just use a replicated pool right now. And of course, okay, now I'm going to create a pool, and you will see that the no, you don't, because you cannot see the webcam. You see now that the nodes are starting to work, and just creating the placement groups on all the nodes already takes some time in the cluster, and during the time, I'm not sure, no, you cannot really see it, the here the yellow LED is on, that means currently the cluster is telling me that it's not really fully available right now. It's working on creating all placement groups that I want to have. So I told it to have 128 placement groups in the cluster, which is not the best thing. For this amount of nodes, you should use more like 512, but for performance reasons with the Raspis, and yeah, it's just faster creating fewer placement groups. In my experience, I'm not sure, but in the first tests, yeah. Yes? Okay. Yeah, okay, what I'm running on the Raspis. I'm running on the Raspberry Pis, I'm running the 42.2 choose image, and initially I wanted to use the full OpenSUSE Ceph packages, and I had some trouble in configuring Ceph, but I'm not sure whether that was due to me or due to the packages. In the end, I decided to use the SLE packages, and then it worked fine. Now I'm quite confident that it was my that I was not capable of configuring it correctly the first time. So I'm pretty confident that it should work with the OpenSUSE packages as well. So yeah, no differences. And I used the ceph-deploy scripts to set up the cluster, because there's another thing available called DeepSea. That's that are some scripts for salt, and that takes a long time to execute on the Raspi. So using the ceph-deploy is just a little faster in the end. And there are not that many nodes that I really need to use salt to manage all the nodes. Okay. Yes, another question.
You're using the SLE repositories on OpenSUSE, and you are booting the Raspis with PXE, or
no? The operating. So I use the juice image that is available for the SD card for Raspberry Pis, and flash the images on the SD cards, booted them, and then I added the SLE repository afterwards, and used them only to install ceph and ceph deploy. Okay. Any other questions or okay? Okay, now the cluster is finished with creating the placement groups and the pool, and now I can write an object into the pool. I will just write the string "Hello World" in an object called test object, and when I hit enter, you see it already takes a lot of time just to store the string "Hello World." It took maybe 3 seconds to do that, and I will just move the command line over here and the webcam over here. And okay, it's still working on things I do not know exactly. But now when I write the object again, you see the red lights jumping, switching on some nodes. I will maybe turn it a little to this side, and you can see the LEDs better. And you see then there's one LED coming online here, and it's reverse. One here, one here. I will just do that again. And you see that they are stored actually on the bottom nodes of each rack. So currently, the bottom nodes of each rack are used to store the three replications of the object. So I will just pull the plug on this and this node over here. And that could be a problem, because maybe I switched off the primary node, and when I want to now read the object, get test object, test object, and write it to the command line. Okay, now, I probably took offline the primary node, and the cluster first needs to realize that the node is gone, and or not the primary node, but the nodes that the client wanted to contact right now. So any case, it takes some time for the pool to the placement groups to get up to date, and then the data should basically be available again. Let's wait and see whether that is going to happen. We can during that time just run ceph status and see what is going on in detail. So, okay, 61 placement groups are still totally fine. Another 67 are, not good right now. And over time, this should change. And more placement groups should be back up running. Yeah, so now most of them are activating. That means they're, now 74 are already back up again. Sorry? On the Raspberry Pis? Yeah. I haven't tried. Because in 42.3, Calamari will not be supported anymore. So SF deploy neither. So you should use DeepSea with the next release anyway. Okay, now all the basement groups are fine again, and I should be able to read the object. Yeah, there it is. So it's working again. And now you see the reading is actually much faster than writing. And I do not have more clients here, but yeah, well, in the end, it should scale. Okay, now let's jump back. What I wanted to do next, and I have to. Okay, I've got a few minutes left, and maybe I will just. No, I think I will stop here. And if you're interested, just I will go over there, and if you have any questions, you can contact me afterwards, and I will free the stage for the next talk. Okay, thank you.